Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later will be Tim Phillips, as we as he's the co-host for the review this week, which I will talk about in a minute. I am here by the open window where there's big trucks going by, which is par for the course as we continue to record here from home for broadcast on CFRU. And it looks like it will be still going that way for the foreseeable future. But as always, we're making do, and thank you so much for staying with us. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new war drama, The Five Bloods, which is now streaming on Netflix. Before we get into that, though, we're going to look at some movie news from the past week. And, yeah, we're going to look into movie news. I said it. There's been some more, let's call it, musical chairs with movie release dates in the recent past, in the last week, mostly along the weekend. And I did want to cover them because some of them are pretty significant. And it does seem to indicate that, you know, we're going to have issues with getting back into the movie theater for the perhaps foreseeable future, at least for like maybe another month. And that's really starting to impact sort of the rearranged movie schedule. Remember back in March when everything closed down, sort of like everything cleared out for April, May, and June for the most part, and most of July. And July was supposed to be the month we were supposed to be like sort of getting back into the movie theaters, but maybe not so much. And we're coming off a weekend where actually, in terms of like major new releases, it was a pretty big weekend. Because you had Artemis Fowl on Disney Plus, which I personally think was always going to bomb because, like, as a movie, Artemis Fowl probably comes about 10 years too late to capitalize on the whole YA phenomenon. But you had Artemis Fowl on Disney Plus. You have The Five Bloods, the new Spike Lee movie we're reviewing this week. That is on Netflix, and then you have The King of Staten Island, which is on video on demand, so all anywhere where you get those movies, where you rent those movies, so YouTube, Google, you know, the Cineplex site, Microsoft, wherever you rent movies, Apple Store, obviously. But looking ahead, July was supposed to be the month we were supposed to get back into the movie theaters. So I have my breaking news here. Well, it's not exactly breaking, but Tenet, as you'll remember, is this big new Christopher Nolan movie that was supposed to come out on July 17th. Last week, they moved the release date of Tenet to July the 31st, which there's a New York Times article that noted that there's like some friction between Christopher Nolan and Warner Brothers just about, you know, when this movie is going to come out. Because, of course, Christopher Nolan is very big on the idea of the theatrical distribution, and he does not want it released on video on demand. Obviously, probably Warner Brothers itself doesn't want it released on video on demand either, but, you know, the window is closing, for summer, for opening in the summer, which is, like, the time to sort of capitalize on big releases, but it's also closing on, you know, whether or not maybe the big theater chains can be saved. When you think about AMC, which has reportedly been hemorrhaging on bankruptcy throughout the pandemic, AMC is the biggest cinema chain in the United States. Just the lost revenue from that, the lost time. And then you're also talking about the glut of releases that have been pushed back, and you have more movies sort of chasing smaller real estate in terms of later in the calendar year. Also, Inception needs to make a lot of money. I think we talked a couple of weeks ago about how it needs to have 80% 80% of theaters open in order to be profitable. And this plays into the big situation going on right now, which is there's a kind of a chicken and the egg situation where theaters need to open for movies, for big movies like Tenet to be released. However, there's really no movies coming out in theaters for the next month, like no big releases. So movie theaters don't really have the, shall we say, supply to justify the risks of reopening, although Cineplex in here in Canada is probably looking at reopening by the end of the month, and you know, there are options, things that are streaming on VOD, they could do, other movies, recent movies that, had played before, theaters closed, they could also do, you know, old-fashioned, screenings of movies, like, you know, just pulling names out of the hat, Ghostbusters or Superman or, you know, things like that, things like they can exhibit just to sort of get the ball rolling. So there is this push-pull. So for right now, Tenet is scheduled for release on July 31st, and on the weekend of July 17th, Warner Brothers is re-releasing a 10th anniversary edition of Inception. I don't think they're adding anything. It's not like a special edition situation. It's just, you know, they're re-releasing the movie in theaters. So you can check it out. I have had it in the back of my mind to do a rewatch of Inception for some time, but just haven't got there for whatever reason. So summer officially kicks off now on July 24th with Mulan. Now, will Mulan move? That's a big question because Wonder Woman has since moved from its August 14th release to an October release. So Warner Brothers is starting to push back their films. Along with Tenet, because Tenet's a Warner Brothers film. So there's a question now that perhaps Mulan might make the move to August 14th, because that weekend is now open. Meanwhile, other release dates getting shifted back. The Matrix 4, which could start production again sometime next month, it is moving back to a release in April 1st, 2022. And I know these dates sound like big in the far future, but, you know, May 2nd, 2021, which was the original release date for The Matrix 4, is less than a year away now, and they had to stop shooting. So I assume they have considerable things left to film, but they are kind of stuck because they don't know when they might start filming, and then there's all this post-production time. So now The Matrix 4 is going to open against, or open a week after Doctor Strange 2 comes out in 2022. Godzilla vs. Kong has also moved. It will now take over the May 21, 2021 slot, which I believe Godzilla vs. Kong was more or less complete. It was in post. I think it was supposed to come out in the fall, but they have moved it to spring next year. Probably a smart move because I think it's already going to be pretty hard to develop in the marketing strategy for that film, considering what happened with Godzilla King of the Monsters. I'm not sure how many people aside from me is interested in seeing that, but putting it in summer and sort of waiting for you know, kind of a more friendlier summer release date is probably a good idea. Spiral, which is the new Saw reboot starring Chris Rock and Samuel L. Jackson, which I was actually very interested in seeing this summer, is still expected to come out this fall. What's not coming out this fall, though, is the Robert Zemeckis adaptation of the Roald Dahl Witches. The Witches, that was supposed to come out. It has since moved to 2021. They have not posted an exact date for that yet. It was supposed to come out in October, I think October 9th this fall. And on that same weekend, though, I mean, it was going to be a very busy weekend anyway, because Romancing the Stone sequel, Death on the Nile. the Kenneth Branagh film that is a follow-up to his Murder on the Orient Express is scheduled to come out on October 9th, as is The Trial of Chicago 7, which is the new Aaron Sorkin film. So, I mean, that weekend is going to be very, very busy. And again, it's coming out the weekend after Wonder Woman 1984, which is coming out October 2nd. Here's some good news. No Time to Die, the new James Bond movie, is moving up in terms of its release date by 5 days, so it's not a big deal. It's going to open November 20th instead of November 25th. So it gives it a kind of a, gets that weekend before the Thanksgiving long weekend in the United States. So probably hoping to capitalize on a little pre-holiday weekend buzz. Again, all this assuming that movie theaters are open. It's the release date staying the same in the UK. The James Bond movies come out a week or so earlier in the UK. Fitting, because he is British spy, so the Brits get him early. That's, you know, I guess I could mention the Tom and Jerry sort of cartoon live-action hybrid film. It has been moved to March 5th of 2021. Which will open it against Ghostbusters Afterlife, Tom and Jerry. I mean, that might be a bit more, there might be a bit more to say about that considering everything that's happening around Black Lives Matter and everything, but that might be one of those where I'm sort of not sure how exactly that will land with moviegoers, whether that's really going to have any effect on its bottom line. I guess we'll see. The other piece of movie news I want to address is concerning The King of Staten Island, which we are going to review next week on this show. But there was a bit of controversy because it was, along with being released on VOD last weekend, it was supposed to come out on in drive-ins. And drive-ins have seen a huge resurgence because of the pandemic, including the Mustang drive-in just outside of town here in Guelph on Highway 7 between Guelph and Rockwood, but they were supposed to release The King of Staten Island in drive-thrus as well, not drive-thrus, drive-ins, except there was some sort of misunderstanding, and Universal Pictures, which distributed The King of Staten Island, did not make it available for drive-ins, which is causing a lot of friction, because Universal has not been too terribly popular with the exhibitors. There was the whole controversy over Trolls World Tour, which Universal released on VOD, much to the chagrin of theater owners, because it was going to be like a big family release, and it usually brings a lot of families into the theater. Universal went for the VOD option so they could get it out there. So they ticked off exhibitors threatening to, like, okay, well, we're not going to take Fast and Furious movies. But I mean, like, seriously, what kind of threat is that? Because, you know, those movies fill a lot of seats. On the other hand, now they've kind of ticked off drive-in owners, which is the only exhibit game in town right now, by sort of pulling The King of Staten Island last minute, regardless of what they're saying about, oh, it was just a misunderstanding that it was not available for drive-thru. Well, it must have gone a little bit beyond a misunderstanding, because a lot of drive-ins were selling tickets to The King of Staten Island. So there's some explaining to do on that part. But it's not been a good year for Universal in terms of exhibitor relations. And that's not really good when you have such limited exhibition options. So do better, Universal. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really in a position to judge. Having said that, I am in a position to judge this week's new film, which is Da 5 Bloods. It is the new Spike Lee movie, so it is surely going to be interesting. But is it a good movie? We're going to find out. I'm going to get Tim on the line. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Simply because our hair is long. Oh, you know, we got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. And oh, picket signs, picket lines, don't punish me.
I see ghosts, y'all. I see ghosts.
Well, that was all of us, man.
Have you seen them too?
Yeah.
Dad come to you at night. Storm and Norm comes to me damn near every night. Now he talked to you like he talked to me.
Yeah, come on.
I don't think so.
Come on. Fist up.
Get in there, David. Get in there. Put your fist up, David. Come on. Go on, you too, Vin. Go ahead. Fist up, man.
Come on, Paul.
And that was a clip from The Five Bloods. It is the new film from Spike Lee, and it stars Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., Johnny Nguyen, and Chadwick Boseman. I am now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well. How about yourself, Adam?
I'm okay. I don't have any suppliques for us today. We're just chilling at home, as always, in separate homes, and hooking up via the Skype to talk about movies.
Yeah, going smoothly so far.
Yeah, so far. well, actually, how many of these have we done? We've gone through about, I think this is like the fourth round of reviews we've gone through. So we've done almost 12 of these from home. Over the last several weeks. So, you know, if you think we'd hit a hiccup by now, maybe I should knock wood.
There we go. Yeah, you should knock on your head, knock wood. make sure there aren't speeding cars right by your window or...
Well, that's inevitable. I live next to the Hamlin. I mean, maybe not so much at, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, but definitely like maybe at 11 o'clock tonight.
Nice. Right, you know, when you're heading for bed, that's when they come out, eh? The street race.
Yeah, Vin Diesel and Paul Walker and the gang. You know, living their life a quarter mile at a time. But we're not here to talk about those guys. We're here to talk about The Five Bloods, which is the new Spike Lee joint. It's released on Netflix, of course. And this is the rare occasion where I suggested to you the film, because The Five Bloods is kind of like the big release this week. It's strange that we're here at the midpoint of June, and the big release that we're talking about is a Spike Lee movie, but these are the times. That's the summer of 2020 for you. But you eagerly accepted the challenge, so why did you want to check out The Five Bloods?
I was really interested, especially after Black Klansman, seeing what Spike Lee would do next. And also, it's a really interesting movie being released by Netflix, which sometimes a challenge to find something that's a feature film that's trying to do something important or say something important on there. You get the odd ones around Oscar time, but I was really happy that this came out on Netflix, and also the times we live in. It's very timely now, especially with all the attention of Black Lives Matters, that this came out around the same time. So I think it's really interesting timing. I thought a really tremendous movie, and I'm glad you suggested it, because I'm glad you suggested it, because something I really wanted to see once you mentioned it.
Yeah, you make an interesting point about sort of the Netflix strategy about movies, because it's really hard to find one. I mean, it's hard to find a Netflix strategy in really anything they do, other than we have to load Netflix with so much stuff that you will never watch it all. And I think they've done the same with movies that they've done with TV shows, where they just kind of, you know, see what sticks. But it's really interesting that they would pick up a Spike Lee movie, that they would feature it prominently when you open up Netflix, that, you know, you're kind of greeted by the Five Bloods trailer, and it's a bold choice. I mean, for Netflix to buy something like The Irishman, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's Scorsese, so there's prestige. Something like Marriage Story, it's again, there's prestige. That doesn't cost a lot of money. It's Noah Baumbach, but he has a following, and you're practically guaranteed Oscars. I don't know if you could say the same for Spike Lee. You might generate controversy. I don't think a lot of controversy has been generated by The Five Bloods, at least not yet. You know, you're buying someone who has a very distinct point of view and doesn't care about rubbing your face in it, and actually, I think, is really happy to rub rub your face in his ideas, and actually maybe kind of hopes that you don't like them. I think Spike Lee likes it when he's on the offensive, not when he's on the defensive.
For sure, yeah, he definitely likes to stir the pot, which is something great in a filmmaker, that they're willing to stir the pot, because so many films that just sort of play it safe, and you see those on Netflix. Like, there's so many films that are your standard genre film. So it's great to see something that, you know, it's a Vietnam movie officially, right? But I went in expecting there'd be like more footage from like the 60s and be more of a period piece, but I thought it was really interesting premise about these men in their 60s, Vietnam veterans, going back to Vietnam to recover gold and also their lost comrade. So I thought that was really, really an interesting take, and how much of it was modern while recalling the past. I thought that was something that was very interesting, and it sort of defied expectations for that kind of genre piece.
Right, it's I think it's a story ideally suited for Spike Lee. From what I understand, this was a script written on spec, and then it came to the attention of Spike Lee, who then turned it in. He brought his ideas into it, including making the soldiers black, or I should say the retired soldiers black. And it's funny too, because there aren't that many movies about black soldiers, or at least from the point of view of black soldiers. There are a lot of war movies that do have black soldiers in them, and a lot of Vietnam movies do have, you know, black soldiers in them, but The Five Bloods makes the point, and it's a historically accurate point, that, you know, when it came to combat in Vietnam, it was the black soldiers who were typically in the worst of the firefights, the worst of the combat situations. They were disproportionately represented in casualties, in terms of how many overall casualties there were. They were disproportionately represented in the ranks of the combat squads. And it seems weird, given the entire history of war movies, you get down to it, and there's like maybe four or five, and two of them are Spike Lee's, because the other one that he did is Miracle at Santa Ana, which I don't think is a great movie, but definitely notable for being a movie told from a war movie told from the point of view from black soldiers.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's great he did this, just given like there's statistics throughout the movie mentioning how African-Americans, I might not be getting the numbers exactly right, but like, I don't know, like 11% of the population, but 23% or something of the soldiers, maybe more, are African-American. Mm-hmm. So it just, it's something I think is a long time coming. And for a movie of this caliber, with the performances it has, I think it'll really, really resonate with people now and probably years to come. I think there's just some excellent performances,
mm-hmm.
especially Delroy Lindo as mm-hmm. the sort of, it's an ensemble piece, but he sort of takes the lead because he has a lot of issues, right? He's wearing the MAGA hat. He's the Donald Trump supporter, but he's gone through a lot in Vietnam, And, you know, he has PTSD and he blames himself for the death of Storm and Norman, who was their squad leader. And he's still going through this decades later. And I thought highlighting his performance, that was a stroke of genius by Spike Lee. And I liked how he used some of those Spike Lee conventions you've seen in his other movies, where Delroy Lindo's looking directly into the camera, you know, giving a monologue to the camera while he's trekking through the jungle, you know, wildly trekking through the jungle, not trusting any of his friends anymore. And I thought that was really interesting how that character played out, and all the other characters, I thought they all had their own stories to tell. And I really liked how it was them going back to Vietnam, because I haven't seen that in a lot of movies, where the veterans are going back to Vietnam of today, which is more open to tourists, right? It's more of a tourist destination in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So it starts with them going back. They go to the Apocalypse Now bar, which is like a popular bar in Vietnam. But then from there, they head out into the jungle on their quest for the buried gold, and also their Storm and Norman, their squad leader, to find his remains. It's interesting how it goes from they're sort of welcomed back into Vietnam as tourists to them going on this quest, which sort of relives the horrors of war they had back during the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s. I think it's a very interesting piece, and I really liked how Spike Lee, when he went back into the past, he had Storm and Norman, the squad leader, played by Chadwick Boseman. He was, you know, young. He was of that age, but he had all the older actors play their younger selves, which at first, when I first saw it, I was like, okay, I didn't quite understand what he's doing. But then after a couple seconds, I was like, okay, I see what he's doing. He's just having these people relive their past as themselves, which I thought was very effective, and I really liked that, as opposed to having a younger actor play them. And you know, you're like, does that person look like them? Is that person really them as a younger actor? Mm-hmm. I thought it felt more personal having the older actors reliving those horrors and that past in the 60s and 70s in Vietnam.
Yeah, it concerns me that people will take the fact that Delroy Lindo and the other actors, Clark Peters is another one of them, that they will see that as a sign that, you know, Spike Lee either cheaped out or they didn't have the money to go through the de-aging process. And if they can't de-age, then, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to bring in an entirely new quartet of younger actors to play the younger guys. I did not read that at all. I read it as, I think there's a lot to the flashbacks that is suspect, not suspect in a negative way, but in terms of like how their Vietnam experiences have influenced, you know, where they ended up in the present day. So I think it's kind of strongly hinted at that they've kind of mythologized Storm and Norman. They've kind of made him this, like, kind of, again, not in a negative way, this kind of cult figure. He was, like, not only was he a great soldier, but he was, like, this great, like, soldier philosopher who had these bright ideas about the gold, about taking the gold back and taking the gold, which they rescue from a downed CIA plane. Using this gold, I think it's Storm and Norman that starts the conversation talking about it as reparations, taking the gold and taking it back to the United States and giving it back to the black people. That I think there's some, not that I doubt the character's recollections about that, but I feel like there's a definite kind of platonic version of Storm and Norman they're seeing, maybe not necessarily representative of who Storm and Norman really was. And I'm talking about them like they're real people, so there you go. But I also don't think it's a coincidence that Chadwick Boseman plays Storm and Norman, because, you know, what is Chadwick Boseman famous for? He's famous for playing Black Panther. Probably most famous for playing Black Panther. And what is Black Panther? But, you know, has sort of become a mythic hero figure in the black community. He is the black superhero. It's the, you know, he's the $1 billion black superhero. So he's a kind of a mythological figure in his own right. And so I think having Chadwick Boseman in that part sort of imbues that into Storm and Norman as well. We see, as an audience, we see Storm and Norman larger than life too. And so we kind of accept the remembrances of the other Bloods in terms of how they remember Storm and Norman.
Yeah, for sure. And Spike Lee has these little flourishes, like where the film at certain points becomes a bit of an essay, and he has these these little clips, you know, clips of Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, and I think they're equating Storm and Norman with that level of social importance, and him being like a Martin Luther King, Malcolm X type figure to them, and how he's always talking about black history. And I think probably Spike Lee is probably earnest in the way he's depicting that, like that character was true to that. But of course, with memories from decades ago, I'm sure that can affect the memories of these soldiers, right? Because it's going back so long, and it's somebody who was taken before their time, and we tend to mythologize, like you said, people who were taken before their time. So, looking at their memories, you know, it's hard to know what's fact versus maybe a bit of a conflation. But I do think Spike Lee was trying to say that the Storm and Norman was an important person in the black community, and if he had come home, he would have done a lot for the black community back in the United States. And it was just tragic that he died. And something Spike Lee brings up a lot, like the theme is they're dying for a war where there's really no purpose, right? They're fighting the Viet Cong, who, you know, there's a quote right at the start, Muhammad Ali, "The Viet Cong never did anything to me," you know, but back home in the United States, you know, the powers that be have done harm to me, but the Viet Cong never did, so I'm not going to fight in Vietnam. And I think that's really central to the film for Spike, is to look at all the harm that's done back home. And, you know, why are they even there in Vietnam, and how tragic it is for them to die in Vietnam for a war that has no purpose for them. And then bringing it back to the modern day, it's like, it's about this gold, and, you know, is that even the most important thing? Of course it is, for like financial stability, to get this gold, get money back to your family and everything. But it's like another mission that's kind of unclear who are your enemies, who are your friends. And I think that's, you know, really what Spike Lee's getting at, and that's what those interludes throughout, like of Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, I think, and Martin Luther King commenting on, you know, all the problems back home. And there's footage early on of the riots back in the 60s and 70s in the United States, and how black people were oppressed then and continue to be oppressed. And so I think that's really what he's looking at, is, you know, this was just sort of like a pointless war, and they lost a brilliant man before his time. I think that's where he's getting at. But of course, with memory, you know, they could be could be getting some facts wrong, or mythologizing their lost friend. Yeah.
And there's also Hanoi Hannah doing the monologue, which was a real thing that, you know, the it happened in Korea too, where you'd have, you know, these women go on the radio and, you know, speaking in English, speaking directly to American soldiers and telling them about all the reasons why they shouldn't fight it. You know, it's part of the propaganda war. But of course, Spike Lee kind of uses it to his advantage to, as he usually does, like, explicitly tell truths that he is also trying to tell in the narrative, and maybe pushes things a bit too far into the blatant, as opposed to letting us assume.
It's interesting that, like, I was watching and I'm thinking, okay, you know, Spike Lee, yeah, maybe he's exaggerating things, you know, with a lot of these characters, and I had never heard of Hanoi Hannah, and then I looked her up. And yeah, she would say stuff very similar to what Spike has her saying, like address black troops even and say, hello, black infantry or whatever the word, black troops. Here's what's happening. Why are you fighting in this war? It's pointless. There's riots going on in Detroit right now. She'd say stuff that was just direct like that. So it's interesting because I think myself and perception with Spike Lee is that he's, you know, always maybe going, exaggerating a bit, you know, for effect. And but it's interesting, like, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Like, a lot of her quotes, from what I read on the internet, it was like directly at certain divisions and certain troops. And yeah, it's very interesting. And I thought that was really handled well in the film, you know. She announces the assassination of Martin Luther King, and you know, and then ties it back to why are you here, why aren't you there, why aren't you back in the States supporting the black people in the States instead of fighting us here in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's there's so much going on in the movie at times. The thing with the flashbacks too is, and I'm sure you noticed it, that the aspect range ratio changes when they go into flashback too. It's like the typical letterbox movie aspect ratio, and then when it goes into flashback, it goes into the 4:3 kind of the TV box, which also adds to my suspicion about how these aren't necessarily flashbacks in terms of capturing every exact detail, but it, you know, in terms of remembering how they remember things, which may not necessarily reflect the accurate version, because Spike Lee does this thing too. And I've seen some people online complain how it looks kind of cheap, but I think that's the point. Again, I think that's the point, where he's like, this is like how we would film this movie as like a 1980s TV movie, of course, when they would make a lot of Vietnam films about the effects of black soldiers and, or the effects of soldiers generally in the battlefield, I should say, not necessarily black soldiers, but there's a very kind of staged, very kind of Hollywood way that those scenes are shot, which I think is the point too, that, you know, this is as much mythology as it is truth. This is as much, you know, how they remember their origin story, and not necessarily how reality might have been. And it's I think Spike Lee is enjoying playing with those ideas.
Yeah, he definitely enjoys playing with filmmaking, little tricks of the trade, obviously. Yeah, it's so noticeable, right? It kind of, when he changes the aspect ratios when you're watching it, but it's like you can tell it's Spike having fun, right? And I think that's part of it too. People who are fans or like Spike Lee, they want him to have fun, you know. Just like other filmmakers, like when Quentin Tarantino makes a movie, he does things that sort of take you away from the story for a second, right? These little stylistic devices, right? And Spike Lee does that. Martin Scorsese, a lot of the greats do it. So he's just having fun with it. And yeah, it might come down to, yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Like, this is the way it would look in the 60s if you saw this movie. This is the way it would look in the 70s or the 80s. He's playing around with that perception of, from what we've seen from past Vietnam movies, and I thought that was really interesting, and I like when he's having fun with it, right? And that's another great thing is when there's the humor, because there's so many dark moments in it and violent moments in this film, but the humor always adds to it, and I think Spike and his team are really great at bringing humor out in a lot of situations as well.
It's interesting you should mention Tarantino, because Spike Lee was famously harsh on Django Unchained. And I can't help but feel that The Five Bloods is kind of Spike Lee's, not version of Django Unchained, but kind of like the way Spike Lee would tell a story like Django Unchained, because he has too much respect for the history and too much respect for the struggle to completely undermine it with the story of sort of like a one former black slave who goes in Terminator-like and destroys a plantation. That's not how Spike Lee would tell that story, but this is how Spike Lee would tell sort of like a black action movie kind of war story, where it's, you know, it's front-loaded with a lot of cultural and current affairs commentary, but at the same time, there is that element of fun to it. This is very much like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and that may be like a heady comparison, but you know,
I think it is very similar to that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like a story of like five guys out on an adventure and getting into trouble and things get serious. And, there is that kind of that very kind of 60s kind of, way that, you know, a lot of the movies of the time would approach like an action movie or an adventure movie. And I think Spike Lee is reinterpreting that through the black experience and through his own, let's call them leanings, whether that's to, you know, cultural commentary or, you know, wanting to comment on the news or throw in a Trump reference or two. And yeah, he's I think he's having fun. And I don't think a lot of people associate Spike Lee with fun, but Spike Lee is definitely capable of having fun. And if you don't believe that, you know, check out something like Inside Man, which is such a great little cop drama that has all the Spike Lee-isms in it, but has so many great performances and has such a great story, and really ties up neat in the end, where, you know, the shades of gray remain intact at the end, but you know, to what extent the right bad guys get punished and the good guys get to save the day. But it's all through Spike Lee's lens, of course. But you want like another example of Spike Lee having fun? Do check out Inside Man.
Sounds good. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that, so I should check that out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's on Netflix or if one of the streamers. I thought it was, but yeah, it's worth checking out. Inside Man. It is probably also Spike Lee's most commercial movie, but you know, it has Denzel and as Jodie Foster, Clive Owen when Clive Owen was still a thing, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and a lot of great actors in it, but it's worth checking out. I do, before we kind of run out of time, I do want to add my appreciation for Delroy Lindo in this movie, because I think, and I don't want to get pilloried for saying this, but I think Delroy Lindo is probably the best realization of what a Trump supporter is. And I mean, we've seen this a lot in
confused and angry and
right. We've seen this a lot in movies in recent years, because I mean, it's so hard to escape the effect of Trump on modern times, just in everyday conversation. But you know, so it's naturally going to have an effect on the movies too. And sometimes it's like a joke here and there. I remember in the last Jurassic Park movie, there's a line where one of the bad guys calls Bryce Dallas Howard a nasty woman, and it's like, oh, okay, ha ha ha, he's quoting Trump. But I feel like in so much as Spike Lee is frightened by Trumpism, he also gets it, because the Lindo character is as you said, he's dealing with his own demons. He blames himself for the death of Storm and Norman. He has never expressed that to the others. So they're kind of left out of the lurch. He's been borderline abusive, if not outright abusive, to his son, who goes along with him on the adventure. And there's a great line in it where Clark Peters is talking to the son, and he's like, you know what, you've loved your father enough for two fathers. And, you know, in that one line, it gives you appreciation of sort of what David's life has been like, David is the son, trying to, you know, find common ground with his father. But, yeah, Paul, which is the Delroy Lindo character, he's disappointed that sort of life didn't turn out the way he'd hoped. You know, he's sort of lost in a sea of his own anger and disappointment and depression and his PTSD, and he needs somewhere to put that. And of course, it's the angriest voice you can find, and there isn't, in modern American politics, there isn't a voice more angry than Donald Trump's. Rather unjustified, given that Donald Trump grew up rich in New York City, as opposed to, like, going, you know, again, Donald Trump also invited to go to Vietnam 5 times, and didn't go. But, you know, looking for someone who can give voice to your anger, it's easy to understand the connection. And there's something very real about that. And it's interesting that it takes sort of Spike Lee to give Trumpism not only a voice in a mainstream movie, but also give it a black voice. That is such a Spike Lee thing.
Yeah, and it makes it more interesting, right? Because it's easy to pick, say, a Trump supporter is this white person from the South or something, right? But it kind of adds to it, because there are some very, very small percentage of supporters who might be from the black community or might be from somewhere you wouldn't expect. And I think this really just shows all the, like, personal anguish Delroy Lindo's going through, and his friends razz him about it. They're like, I can't believe you're the one black guy who voted for Trump, right? You're the one supporter. But like you said, it's kind of true to who he is. He's confused. He's angry. He wants a better life. He wants to make his life great again, make America great again, you know, so it does strike a nerve, and it's an interesting element to have, as opposed to having 5 characters all with the same political views. And I thought it was really good in the ensemble how, you know, one of them was considered wealthy, and one had a Vietnamese girlfriend he's coming back to, and I thought these elements made it really interesting, so it wasn't just this myopic focus or with everyone with the same sort of character traits. So
right,
and I thought that was really interesting, his character, and I thought that was just a tremendous performance in that role. You can see his anger, you can see his paranoia, and it's all expressed really, really well on film.
Right, and I don't want to say it's Oscar worthy, it might be, but I think that Delroy Lindo is definitely a standout. I'm not sure he's had material like this to sort of chew on in a while, but I think he definitely sticks out, and I think he's definitely worth award consideration. Whether that happens, who knows? Whether there's an award season this year, who knows? But what I do find interesting, because I have to tie everything back to Parasite, but, you know, there is a similar commentary to that in Parasite where, you know, the people who are sort of on the lower ends of society will eat each other to just get one step ahead of the others. And you sort of see that when they do find the gold, you know, they return to Vietnam as brothers, and all these happy remembrances and talking about the good old days with serving under Storm and Norman. And then when they find the gold, it kind of turns. And you see that in Parasite too, when everybody realizes that only one of them gets to stay in the Shangri-La of this rich family's house. Everybody turns on each other. and Spike Lee is I think definitely on the same page as Bong Joon-ho with that.
For sure. Yeah.
Any other thoughts about The Five Bloods?
I think it's definitely something to check out. And like you said, you open up Netflix, it's right there on the homepage, so it's easy to find. And I'd recommend it. Very entertaining, very thought-provoking, and I'm glad Spike Lee is making important movies still. You know, in 2020.
Right, it's been he did a couple of films before Do the Right Thing, but I mean it's been 31 years since Do the Right Thing, and he's had his ups and downs, that's for sure, but he's really seemed to capitalize on his I think the Black Klansman sort of allowed him to, you know, take back a rightful place in terms of the Hollywood conversation. And I think he exploited that place to great effect, making The Five Bloods. And I think it's a rewarding movie in a lot of ways. I don't think it's his best movie, but I think it's pretty tight. Could have shaved off a half hour, but I'll leave that there as maybe a note for next time, Spike, you know, to, you know, make it a bit tighter. not that I'm in a position to really judge.
Send him an email, Adam, yeah.
I'll tweet
it to him.
I'll send him a DM. Yeah, I can only imagine, right? I can't imagine Spike Lee generally has his DMs open, but unless it's to the Knicks, but We'll leave that there. Tim, if people want to find you on the internet, how can they find you and send you DMs?
Oh, yeah. Flash in the Deadpan on all social media. FlashintheDeadpan@gmail.com email. And, strange times we're living in. I've done plays and films, and now I'm trying to write more prose, going back to what I used to be interested in about 20 years ago. So I'm trying to write some short stories and working on a novel. So hopefully at some point that gets complete, but I'm really enjoying the process right now, getting back to my writing roots.
Is the quarantine going on too long, or do you need it to go on longer to realize this?
Yeah, it's funny you said that, because it's like, yeah, now things are opening up a bit, and I'm like, I actually need more time here, guys. You know, can we just slow things down? But we'll see. But it's been a good experience, at least getting back to something I have a passion for, that, you know, I've written screenplays and plays and stuff, but writing prose, it's fun getting back to that. Even if it the quarantine ends tomorrow, I think I've found something I want to continue on doing, which is great.
All right, well, we'll let you get back to it. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media at Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my Guelph Politico site at guelphpolitico.ca. And I'll also put in a plug for some of the stuff I've been doing on Nightmare on Film Street, and you can check that out. I've been recapping Penny Dreadful, City of Angels every Sunday, and that gets posted every Monday. And I also did in my latest remake Redemption column, which appropriately for Father's Day this coming weekend is The Stepfather, and that should be online later this week, so check that out. In the meantime, stay tuned for more programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. A little bit of a programming change in order for some pandemic programming at 2 p.m. on weekdays here on CFRU. So our next week's show will be at 3 p.m. here on CFRU. And stay tuned for more end credits next week. And we will see you then.
Thank you.